Good morning. It is wonderful to see all of you by face or see your name across the screen. Before we get started, I just want to remind all of us, me included, that at times like this, it feels like, it can feel like I am practicing just for me. And that I'm doing well just to practice for me to get through this whole time. And the beauty of this is that I am never practicing just for me. And you are never practicing just for you. We are always practicing for each other as well. So, however you're doing that in these crazy, wacky times, thank you for doing it, including being here today. So, thank you very much. I was here a year ago, giving a talk that was titled Turning Toward Joy. And in that talk, I said that Buddhism is a relentlessly optimistic religion or philosophy or spiritual path or whatever you call your Buddhism. And I have more great news today. Your Buddhahood has been predicted. And when I say your Buddhahood, I don't mean your Buddhahood as Dharma Rain. I don't mean your Buddhahood in aggregate. I don't mean your Buddhahood as a Sangha. I mean your Buddhahood. And not only has your Buddhahood been predicted, but it was predicted by Shakyamuni Buddha himself 2600 years ago. My teacher says that when you look at Buddhism at a macro level, and you take all of the teachings and the guidance and the scripture and the philosophy, and you kind of roll it all up to the biggest picture, that in Buddhism, without fail, evil is vanquished and good prevails. And that in Buddhism, everything is moving toward enlightenment at all times, whether we feel it or not, whether we get it or not, whether it seems like that or not. And this optimistic teaching is found in many, many places in Buddhist scripture. Scripture is replete with some version of this teaching. And you can find it all the way back in the Pali Canon literature that started to get written down as early as 100 BCE to the Lotus Sutra, which started being written around the same time, maybe a little later in a few hundred years after that. All the way into the writings of Dogen in the 1200s. It's throughout Buddhist teaching. And this prediction by Shakyamuni Buddha that all sentient beings will ultimately realize Buddhahood, including me, including you, really starts. One of the source documents for it is a sermon he gave on Vulture Peak in northeastern India. And this was the site where he is said to have given many of his most important seminal teachings or sermons. And this was back in the 5th century BCE. And in this sermon, as is often the case in some of these early writings, there were reported to be 80,000 bodhisattvas assembled for this teaching that he was delivering. And the Pali Canon says this: Shakyamuni Buddha addressed 80,000 other bodhisattvas, saying, "Within this great assembly of countless heavenly beings, both human and non-human, as well as male and female monastics and male and female laity, if such as these, who are all standing before the Buddha now, should hear but a single verse or line from my teaching, which is the flowering of the wondrous Dharma, and take joy in it for even a moment, I will give them all a prediction of their Buddhahood. Beyond question, all will realize supreme, fully perfected enlightenment. Elsewhere in the Pali Canon, there is a lot that is written and taught about the different stages of realization, the different phases on our path toward awakening or enlightenment or realization or recognizing our own Buddhahood. And the first stage is the stream entrance, which is for us in this particular life in our current human form is absolutely critical. And this is, according to the Pali Canon, the point at which we break our first three fetters that most commonly hinder us from seeing reality. And those are having a fixed view of ourselves, common teaching we've all heard a lot about, doubt. And the third is being attached to rites and rituals as ends in and of themselves. This is the point at which we first catch a glimpse of seeing through our false views and our false approaches. And it's an understanding that draws us into entering the stream. And the beauty of this teaching is that once we enter the stream is so clear, so strong, so resolute, so intuitive, so organically true, so much a part of our birthright, that the stream inevitably results in our reaching realization. There are four practices that lead to us entering the stream. One is association with people of integrity. So who we associate with matters and plays a role. Listening to the true Dharma. And in Buddha's day, as today, there were plenty of teachers, including plenty of wandering mendicants, that were out teaching and preaching lots of different things. So he was always very clear that there was a difference between just any teaching and the true Dharma. Appropriate attention, which goes to right view and right framing of our understanding, and practice in accordance with the Dharma. The second stage is being a once returner. Then the third is to be a non-returner. And the fourth is to be an arahant. But once we become a stream entrant, some places in the Pali Canon predict that we will never then again return in non-human form. We will have reached the penultimate state of human form and the opportunity that presents. And some places in the Pali Canon even say we will be reborn no more than seven times, that our time on the circle of birth and death and rebirth is limited permanently, and we are inevitably flowing toward realization. When the Buddha died at the age of 80, he had some sort of stomach poisoning, we think, and he was dying, and he was surrounded at his death by 500 bhikkhus, which were his disciples, parts of his Sangha, and he was speaking in his final teaching to Ananda, his chief disciple, and he said to Ananda on his deathbed, moments before he died, "Indeed, Ananda, even the lowest in spiritual attainments among these 500 bhikkhus is a stream entrant, not liable to fall into lower states, is assured and is bound for enlightenment." So even on his deathbed, he continued with his assurance and prediction that once we enter the stream, our realization is inevitable. Dogen, now fast forwarding to the 1200s and the Shobogenzo, wrote a fascicle on predicting Buddhahood. And this is how he wrote about it. And he attributes this teaching to what he says the Buddha said himself. The Buddha once said, although there are many forms for affirming Buddhahood, to summarize them briefly, there are eight. First, you recognize it in yourself, but others do not recognize it. Second, everyone else recognizes it, but you do not. Third, both you and everyone else recognize it. Fourth, neither you nor anybody else recognizes it. Fifth, those close to you perceive it, but those distant to you do not. Sixth, those distant to you perceive it, but those close to you do not. Seventh, both those close to you and distant from you perceive it. And eighth, neither those close to you nor distant from you perceive it. The affirmation of one's Buddhahood is just like this. So do not occupy yourself with thoughts that your Buddhahood cannot be affirmed because it has not been recognized or appreciated by the living spirit within that smelly skin bag of yours. I love this teaching because it is such a reminder that our progression is not linear. It is not clean and orderly. It is not sequential. We don't graduate from first grade and then enter into second grade. We don't move from middle school into high school. There are times and moments when I catch glimpses of my true Buddha nature and other people don't. There are times I am confused and clouded and spinning up. And I am the last person that can catch a glimpse of my Buddhahood, but other people either close to me or far away from me, they can see it. Sometimes we both see it. Sometimes nobody sees it. It's just this wonderfully organic process of constant arising and subsiding and coming and going and glimpsing and not glimpsing. And through it all, the progression toward Buddhahood is still happening. Dogen continues in what I find to be this breathtaking spirit of generosity and assurance of the inevitability of our own realization in the Fukan Zazengi, when he writes something that we chant a lot: continue to live in such a way, and you will be such a person. The treasure store will open up itself, and you may enjoy it freely. He goes on in the Kojikaimon, another thing that we chant frequently and are familiar with, when he writes, all things, earth, trees, wooden posts, bricks, stones, become Buddhas once this refuge is taken. From these precepts come forth such a wind and fire that all are driven into enlightenment when the flames are fanned by the Buddha's influence. This is the merit of non-action and non-seeking, the awakening to true wisdom. I came to Dharma Rain 18 years ago. I encountered these teachings, specifically the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and the 16 Bodhisattva Precepts. I was deeply moved. And grateful. For on one hand, their clarity, their simplicity, and their directness, and simultaneously, on the other hand, their complexity, their elegance, and their nuance. I took classes for a year. I entered in, as many of us do, through the Wednesday evening class series. I went to Jukai, I showed up, I went to every moment of it, I took the precepts, I was so excited, I settled into my new practice, And it did not go easily for me. I struggled mightily. I wrestled, I fought with, I grappled with lots of aspects of the teaching and the practice, especially Zazen. I didn't like Zazen. It drove me nuts. I was completely flummoxed. When people would talk about their experience while Zazen, as centering and calming and clearing and opening, I thought to myself, who are these people? What are these? Where do these people come from? How do these people do this? What kind of experience are they having that I'm not? For me, Zazen was a battle of wills. It was physically uncomfortable. It was mentally uncomfortable. It was a test of endurance. And I spent most of the time in Zazen waiting for the bell to ring. And once the bell rang, I breathed a great sigh of relief so that I could get up and start to move. It was not easy for me, and it did not come naturally for me. But I looked all around, and somehow the teaching still resonated. Their beauty, their elegance, their simplicity, their relevance, their truth for me still resonated deeply. So I did what people like me do, who are accomplishment-oriented and achievement-oriented and task-oriented. I turned toward my intellectual habit of investigating words and chasing phrases. And I spent several years doing just that. And if you've been at Dharma Rain or any Zen Buddhist place longer than a nanosecond, you know there is no shortage of opportunity to investigate words and chase phrases. The lists are endless. I thought that I understood the basics of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the 16 Bodhisattva precepts, but that was only the beginning. So I was around, and all of a sudden there are three treasures, and then there are different schools of Buddhism, and then there's Pali, and then there's Sanskrit, and I had to figure out like what those were and what's the difference. And then there are some really big teachings like dependent origination and samsara and samadhi. And so I had to kind of chase that down and figure out what does that mean and what do I do with that stuff. And then there was karma, which just took forever for me to kind of untangle. And I still can get kind of tangled up in that and what it is and what it isn't. Then I would show up and somebody would be giving a talk and they would say, oh, well, that comes from the Brahma Viharas. You know about the Brahma Viharas. And I thought, oh my goodness, I don't know anything about the Brahma. What's a Brahma Vihara? Now I need to go figure out what the Brahma Viharas are. And then somebody would say, the five aggregates. And I thought, oh, what on earth are aggregates? So then I have to go chase down aggregates. And then there's the Pali Canon. And then there are the three sections of the Pali Canon. And then we have all these different ancestors and they're different national lines of ancestors. Some are Indian, some are Chinese, some are Japanese. Then we have a separate women's lineage. So I had to go study up on that and take classes on that and read books on that. And the references to stuff just never stopped. There's the Dhammapada, the enlightenment stories, the Jataka tales, the wisdom sutras, the lotus sutra, the Avatamsaka sutra, the diamond sutra, the platform sutra. There's Dogen, there's our lineage. It just goes on and on. I took lots of classes. I'm a 20-year veteran of what should be the 3-year Dharma Rain Seminary program. I went to workshops. I read books. I went to Sanzen. And I read and I thought and I studied and I wrote papers and I tried my best to navigate this wild, crazy world in part, in retrospect, as a way to keep practicing even while I resisted Zazen mightily. And during all of this time, three things happened. Despite my discomfort with some aspects of the practice, I kept coming back. And sometimes I came back out of boredom. Sometimes I came back and I was irritated. Sometimes I came back and I was joyful. But I just kept coming back. Another thing is I kept practicing, and not just when I went to Dharmarang, but I practiced at home. I practiced when I traveled. I just continued plodding away in my own remedial way as best I could. And the third thing was I gave myself permission to be authentic. And for me, that meant being honest and candid and vocal about my struggles with the practice. For me, that meant not shining it on, not pretending to be a better Buddhist than I was, not pretending to be a better student than I was, not pretending to understand or grasp concepts that I didn't or had not yet, not acting and talking like other people acted and talked like, but to be authentic about my challenges and my struggle. My teacher unlocked this quandary I was in when he said to me once, after listening to me moan about Zazen for a long time, "Your gateway into this practice may not be Zazen." I was flabbergasted. It was the very first time that anybody had said to me, "There could be a path for you, and it may not be Zazen. It could be Kinhin. It could be mindfulness. It could be Thich Nhat Hanh's mindfulness walks. It could be reflection exercises at the end of every day. It could be all kinds of things." And once he said that, once he allowed for that possibility, I immediately got tired of my story as the bad Buddhist who hated Zazen. And I shut up about it. In the process, I began to realize that my early years in practice and all of that struggle recognizing my own Buddhahood, or even catching glimpses of it, was the result of four misdeeds on my part. The first was duality. I was caught up in dualistic thinking. See, Zazen was something people like you did. That was what Bukai did. That was what Jiko did. That's what Kakumyo did. They were doing Zazen. What I was doing wasn't Zazen. It couldn't be. It wasn't the right Zazen. It didn't quite count. Their Zazen counted. Buddhahood and recognizing glimpses of it, that was out there. That was external for me. That was not at all part of my experience day to day. It was external for me. Equanimity and wisdom, that was something you had, people like you had. I couldn't grasp it. It wasn't within me. It's external to me. The second sin, I think, on my part was comparing mind. You did it better than me. Others got it quicker than me. Some of you were smarter than me. Some of you were better at this than me. Some people I entered the stream with looked to me to be a lot farther down the stream than me. So lots of judgment and lots of comparing myself to other people, and the assumption that they were doing it better than me. The third was lots of self-doubt. What's wrong with me? How come I can't do this? What is the issue? What are my problems? How am I missing the boat? And the fourth was, if you notice a common theme through all of these things, this was an incredibly selfish view and an entirely self-centered perspective. It was 100% about me. When will I do it right? When will it be easier for me? When will I feel better about it? And it had nothing to do with you or the Sangha or any other sentient being. It was 100% me. The most powerful teaching that my teacher ever gave me is that it is in this second, this instant, this breath, this flash, this moment, that we see it. For most of us, it's not the huge cataclysmic macro-level breakthroughs. It's not Moses parting the Red Sea and the clouds part and bodhisattvas float down on clouds and music begins to play. It's not states of wonderment that last for days and weeks and months on end. It's not monumental shifts in our entire worldview and perspective and personality that allow us to kind of float permanently through the world in an incredibly radically different sort of way. For most of us, it is not that. My teacher said to me that the moment I caught myself wandering and distracting in Zazen, and I caught it and I brought myself back, that's it, he said. That's it, right there, you did it. And he taught me that it was the accumulated impact of this second and this moment and this flash and that ever so brief realization that over time was the key. And that over time, I would develop a little bit more clarity, a little bit more wisdom, a little bit more equanimity. And even then, not permanently, but for another second, for another instant, another flash, or another breath. Katagiri was one of the early Japanese Zen priests that came to America to begin to spread the Dharma in the West. And he wrote something, he founded the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, and he wrote something that, for me, sums this up beautifully. He wrote, "The changes that occur through spiritual practice are not really your business. If you make them your business, you will try to change your life directly. If you try to change your life directly, no matter how long you work at it, you will not satisfy yourself. So, if you truly want to change your life, you should just form the routine of doing small things day by day. Then your life will be changed beyond your expectations. There is no explanation for this." I'm with Katagiri all the way through that teaching, except for his last sentence. Of course, there is an explanation for this. And that is that our Buddhahood has been predicted. We have a comment from Yuatsu. Thanks. He wants to open with a complaint. He ordered his Buddhahood and he has Amazon Prime, but it's been over 2 days and it's still not here yet. My counsel to you is it's on the way. It's happening whether you realize it or not. It's coming. It's inevitable. Anybody else have a comment? Feel free to unmute yourself. Patrick has a comment. What do you do when feelings of unworthiness come up again? How do you remember your Buddha nature? That's a great question, because feelings of unworthiness certainly still come up periodically. I guess for me, they last less time than they used to. So I can pivot from that to some other sort of feeling more quickly. It kind of comes and goes faster than it used to. And my ability to kind of see my Buddha nature in a moment, just ever so briefly. It's easier now than it used to be. It feels like it takes less work, less effort, and it happens a little more often. It doesn't stay. It doesn't last. I don't, experience uber states that just go on and on for days and weeks. But it is more frequent. It's easier, and the unworthiness is less often, and it's briefer. There's more air around it. It's easier to kind of let it go. Thanks, Patrick. Gabe says, "Thank you so much for a beautiful talk. I want to know more about doubt and how we can respond when we notice it." So doubt is one of the three fetters that we have to grapple with letting go of as part of becoming a stream entrant. And doubt could be interpreted by different ones of us in different ways, at different times, under different conditions. For me, doubt for me was doubting myself, doubting my own inherent, not worth as a person, but my inherent Buddha nature. The fact that it wasn't external to me, far away from me, and something I had to kind of go crawl over beds of nails to achieve. For me, that's what doubt was. For other people, doubt could be about something else. Doubt could be doubting the teaching itself, doubting the rightness or the soundness of the teaching. But for me, the doubt was about me. Again, I told you it was very selfish. It was all about me. So everything came back to me, including doubt. Somebody says, Bukai. Thomas, can you say more to describe? I got tired of my story instantly. You know, this was the second moment in my life when I got really, really tired of a story, and it ended up having very large consequences. The first was when I first came to Dharma Rain, my story was I am an angry former Christian. That was my story. I have been wounded by Christianity, fundamentalist evangelical Christianity. I'm angry about it. I'm wounded. And if you scratched the surface, all that would just bubble up to the top, and I could go on at great length about it. And I held on to that story for a long time, and it was exhausting, and it got boring, and I just got tired of it. And that's what led me to come to Dharma Rain. And I think in a way, something similar happened. I guess I needed somebody just to say something or kind of open up the hatch or kind of open up the pressure cooker or just give me some outlet for this pent up energy and frustration and spinning by saying something to me like, you know what? Okay, you don't like Zazen? Okay. It's okay. I mean, that alone... That alone was enough to help me think, holy cumoli, I can let go of this now. I don't really have an excuse to hold on to it. My teacher let go of it for me. We're back to Yuetsu. Now he has a slightly more serious question about, rather than his Amazon Prime order. Oh, interesting. You've always had a bit of an irksome problem with the concept of your Buddhahood has been predicted, as it smacks too much of philosophical determinism. Anyone else have issue with that? That's an interesting question. So I guess, Yokoko, do you have anything to say to that? Or Kakemyo, do you have anything to say to this concept smacking of determinism? And how that's hard for some of us or uncomfortable for some of us. I'll say something while we're waiting for either of our two abbots to speak. I hope one of them will speak. I think, as I understand it, and I listened to my teacher Gyokoko talk about this concept with me, the beauty and the power of this is we are all moving toward Buddhahood as we speak. And it's not just we, all sentient beings. And that is the true nature of things. And it's happening whether we like it or not, whether we feel like it or not, whether things are going well or they're not going well. The whole arc of the universe, to borrow a term from Martin Luther King Jr., is kind of arching in that direction. Through crises, through disasters, through COVID-19, through wars, through epidemics, through divorces, through getting fired, through bankruptcy, I mean, whatever our situation is, through terminal illness, through all of it, things are that is kind of our condition, and things are all moving in that direction. I find that to be extraordinarily liberating and incredibly generous. You may not. It may feel to you like Presbyterian determinism, or what's the other word they use in Christianity for something. Anyway, that may rub you the wrong way. I guess if it rubs you the wrong way, it may not be the right teaching for you. So set it down, I guess.
All right, so I would, since you asked, what I would say there is that for myself, it really feels like gravity. Like it's just, there's a inevitability to it. And if I can, you know, when I'm holding that, it gives me a sense of confidence and a sense of, you know, this optimism that you have been talking about. And that's much more supportive to my practice than this sense of kind of skepticism or the sense of trying to, when I'm trying to decide if this is like philosophically correct or not, I don't like how that feels. You know, it feels like I'm getting persnickety and tight about practice, and I don't want to hold it like that. I don't like that version of me. I've certainly practiced it, but I don't find it to be as useful in terms of how I get through my day.
Maybe, do you think also, Kakimo, there's a little bit of questions of King Nalanda? It's like, well, what about this and what about that and what's the meaning of life?
Those are questions which don't tend towards edification.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of along those lines?
Yeah, could be.
Yeah. Carl asks, how do you feel about your Zazen experience nowadays? And I like Zazen. I don't always like it. It's so odd to describe how you feel about Zazen, but this marked my journey for some years at Dharma Rain. It didn't last a few months. It lasted for years at Dharma Rain. So it's been years since I felt this way. It's been many years, actually. So I actually spent a year up at Dharma Rain living there and exploring whether or not to ordain as a monk. And, you know, I mean, so the fact that I even consider doing that, I guess, shows you how far the animosity towards Zazen has come. But no, I sit. I appreciate my sitting. Sometimes it feels better or more productive than others, but it doesn't really matter. I sit anyway, and it's been quite a few years since I felt this way. So thanks for asking. Jujitsu says, perhaps your Buddhahood has been predicted ought to be understood as encouragement to stay on the path rather than, quote, your Buddhahood is right here behind door number 3. And I concur with that. I think, you know, it's not a game show. It's not a prize. It's not a reward if we do it right. But I think Kakimu spoke to understanding it or receiving it as encouragement. And I absolutely, that's, I think, feels like good medicine to me. If it's good medicine to others of you, that's great. Others of you want to either type a comment or unmute yourself and say something for us? You know how to unmute yourself on this thing? One new message is coming that I can't read. Oh, who determined that you would keep practicing, says Sosets. That's a great question. Feels like a Mondo question, actually. I think I'm going to give you a very practical answer, and then I'll give you a more spiritual answer. My partner, Kevin, determined that I would keep practicing. It's a huge practical impact. There was, there was just an expectation, an accountability. And so I just want to be honest that there was quite a practical aspect to that. And I think it was my, way seeking mind. I think it was my Buddha nature and my way seeking mind that kept me practicing. I think the me in me was what was in the way. That was what got engaged in dualistic thinking, in comparing mind. That was me. But I think what kept returning was way seeking mind and Buddha nature. Jiko says we can fight our inheritance and we can certainly fight our Buddhahood. And I absolutely resonate with fighting Buddhahood and fighting our inheritance. Dakota says, how do we recognize our authentic response in each moment? Oh, goodness gracious. It doesn't seem like something one can effort into. I don't know, Dakota, that perplexes me a little bit. I only can speak to my authentic response in a moment. I don't know about yours or anybody else's. I can't give you any advice, but I think part of what my teacher taught me was that the moment I start to kind of criticize my response or evaluate my response, judge my response, label it good, bad, or indifferent, label it Buddhist or non-Buddhist, label it successful or not, positive or negative, once I do all that, it's over. And that the more authentic response is, if I'm angry, I'm angry. If I'm feeling happy, I'm happy. If I'm grieving, I'm grieving. If I'm bored, I'm bored. And, you know, that's kind of the end of it. And, you know, Buddhist teaching would say that even that much is pretty far down the path. There's a lot that goes into even that. But for me, when I just let be whatever my response is, and I just kind of stop it as soon as I can, kind of the judging mind, the more authentic for me. And that's, for me. Because once I get involved, then it gets all mucked up. And because I just, you know, I don't trust myself and I get really tricky, I get clever, and I start to kind of dodge and weave and interpret and filter through past stories and screens, and it's just, the sooner I can kind of let that go, the better. That's how I am able to do authentic response in a moment. I don't know if that's at all helpful for you. I think it's kind of funny because my teacher, Kyokuko, is unable to unmute. So she doesn't have the capacity to intervene and either correct me or steer me in a different direction or shout me down or anything. And I think there's some cosmic thing at play in that. Kyokuko, what does that feel like? You are silenced. I could say anything. I could say anything and attribute it to you and you couldn't stop me. Okay. Anything else? So in coming days, when the world continues to be crazy and you feel despondent or not despondent or happy or sad or lonely or whatever, I just invite you to reflect on the fact that 2,600 years ago, Shakyamuni Buddha himself predicted your Buddhahood.